Donald Jeffries Show.
And welcome to the Donald Jeffries Show. This is Donald Jeffries. Very special guest tonight. He's become a friend all the way from Paris. Actor Nick Mancuso. Boy, you look at his IMDb credits and he has like a million credits. It's amazing. All the work he's done. You've probably seen him in all kinds of television shows and movies. And he's also, talking to him and everything, he's a writer. He's kind of a Renaissance man. He can talk intelligently about so many different subjects, and we're going to kind of go all over the place tonight as we usually do. So, Nick, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Donald, and thank you for the compliments. I don't recognize that guy, but it apparently is me.
Absolutely. Well, so people will probably mostly know and be most interested in your acting career. So before we go into other subjects, give a brief overview. Like, what are the highlights? What would people most know you from in terms of Hollywood? And are you still there? I mean, you certainly don't have the mentality of Hollywood. You're in Paris, but I don't know how much work you could get in Hollywood at this point, but what's left of Hollywood?
Well, I've never been really a Hollywood actor. I got my start. I ended up in Hollywood, and I certainly ended up doing a lot of mainstream type Hollywood films. I worked with, a lot of people, Charlton Heston, and I worked with some of the big stars, Sophia Loren and Catherine Deneuve, and over the years, Kim Basinger, Michelle Pfeiffer, and so forth. I worked with just about everybody in the business, but I was never that interested in, quote, stardom or fame or any of that. I was a shy, scared little immigrant kid who grew up on the shores of Lake Ontario in Toronto. I had migrated, my family migrated from the south of Italy in Calabria, small mountain town in the Aspromonte region, in 1955, 1956. I was born 1948, and I was 54. And I came on the sister ship of the Lusitania in steerage, which was called the Volcania, from Naples to Halifax, Canada. And I was a little bit like Vito Corleone. I was 5 or 6, staring at the coastline of Canada, hitting land, and thinking to myself, where the hell am I going? I didn't speak English, obviously. I've been told by the old people in the town that I grew up in, which hadn't changed in thousands of years, we didn't even have electricity in the small town, that the sky in America was very low. So I thought America was a place that had all these chimney stacks and the smoke was going sideways and people had to bend down to walk. And I was just terrified of going to America. And I was worried there wasn't watermelon. So I brought watermelon seeds with me in my pocket to plant them in America. This was a long time ago traveling was... It was like going to America. It was like going to the moon. What is that? Hello?
Yeah. Hello, you there?
I'm here. I don't know what all that racket is, but can you hear me?
Yeah, you're fine.
Oh, okay. So that's what it was like coming in. And then I learned English listening to Bugs Bunny cartoons. I never had any interest in... the arts or in acting. I liked baseball and I liked science. And really, as a kid, all I wanted to do was be an astronomer. So you asked, Donald, so I'm going to tell you what happened.
Okay.
So I got interested, like I said, I was interested in Nikola Tesla at the age of 12. The great inventor, one of the greatest minds of our time.
Yes.
The man that brought us the modern world, and of course Edison took all the glory, but it was Tesla that created Niagara Falls and alternating current, and was working on actually energy transmission back in 1903. direct energy transmission without wires. Electric car, 1904, 1905. Mm-hmm. First radio transmissions were not done by Marconi. They were done by Nikola Tesla, who was a Serbian immigrant who migrated to New York, one of the great minds. And that's the kind of stuff that fascinated me. And Albert Einstein was my hero when I was 9. So I had a rather unusual kind of, I guess you might say, brain.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I was just interested in all that stuff. And acting and the movies and the theater really just weren't part of my vocabulary. And then series of things occurred. One was we went back to Italy when I was 12. My mother had had it with Canada. And me and my brothers and sisters were shipped back. And while I was in Italy, my Uncle John, God rest his soul, who was a professor of literature and a sculptor and music and all this stuff, introduced me to art and poetry. And he taught me how to speak Italian, because I didn't speak Italian. I speak a Sicilo-Calabrian dialect, which is what the language is of most of the Italians in America is, because most of the Italians in America are from the south, from Naples on to Sicily, in what was once a country known as the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, which was then invaded and destroyed by the House of Savoy in the north under the banner of unification. We were destroyed back in 1870 and invaded, and over 1.5 million people were murdered. The Bank of Sicily and Naples was destroyed. All that stuff was shipped north. And therein began the so-called unification. They took a lunatic by the name of Giuseppe Garibaldi. They put him up on a horse. All constitutional rights were suspended for 20 years. And the what was, in fact, at that time, the third richest country in Europe, the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, and Naples being the third most important city after London and Paris, was utterly destroyed, thereby resulting in this massive migration that began in the late 1870s. My grandfather migrated in 1905, he was a little bit like he went to America back then before returning back to Italy. And therein, we lost 30 million people, traveled all over the world. So what you know of as the Italians isn't really Italian. We are former members of a country called the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, and most of Italians don't know that. They don't know their own history because it's all been covered over, like most things.
Well, that's what I admire about you. You really have such a wide breadth of knowledge, and I want to tell you in the chat room already, Chris is crediting you. He says, Nick was the very first slasher in the 1974 horror classic Black Christmas with the late John Saxon. That's the one that Andrew Martin played a part in, right, from SCTV?
Yeah. That was one of the first things I did back in 19, I think it was 72. Mm-hmm. And I played the role, the part of the slasher Billy in Black Christmas, which has been remade 3 times. I did it standing on my head to compress my thorax, and myself, Bob Clark, God wonderful director.
Yeah.
And this other actress, I think her name was Mugsy Sweeney, are basically the voice of Billy, but I'm primarily Billy because I'm the guy that said, "It's me, Billy." And Margot Kidder was in it too.
Lois Lane
and Superman,
and towards the end, I was communicating with her a lot in social media. She was really
wonderful medium.
She was really out there, but she was very politically radical. And she had read my blog and everything, and I was crushed when she died. But there's somebody else in the chat room, Jake Jordash, who said you're a legend, he says he knows I'm listening to this.
Jake is a wonderful man. Jake, as I guess, is the president of my Irish fan club and a great supporter for many, many years.
Wow.
He's helped me a great deal. Welcome, Jake. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you made it. But yeah, I've had a really interesting career. I've had a very interesting life because I went into, as I said, what happened to me was I was not interested in the arts, but then my uncle opened my eyes to poetry, and I started writing poetry when I was 12, and you know, and in Italian, because he taught me Italian. I didn't speak Italian. And then when I went back to Canada, I fell into a deep, deep depression. And it was a really terrible time. I didn't want to be in Canada. I hated the industrial wastelands of the north. The south of Italy is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful country. You know, just gorgeous, like California, you know, and... Yeah. And, you know, sunlight and color and everything, and, you know, it was 20 below zero, you know, and the only thing you could really do is play hockey, you know.
Right.
That's about it, you know, and I was not a big fan of hockey. I like baseball, but anyway.
Yeah.
So I ended up, by just circumstances, because I used to have a semi-photographic memory, we used to have these little competitions. I went to Bloor Collegiate Institute in Toronto, which is an immigrant high school. Very bright kids in that school. And I had a wonderful teacher, Gustav von Viersen Tripp, his name was. God rest his soul. And Gustav had a great sense of humor, and he loved to give us kids quizzes as to who could memorize something the fastest. He'd give us 15 minutes, you know, 5 minutes. So one time, there were only two guys, me and this guy, Tom Agnew, who became a physicist, actually, and who used to be able to memorize. So, you know, one day he says to me, after giving us 5 minutes, he says, "Nick, you know it, don't you?" And I went, "Yeah." He said, "Stand up and recite it." I was petrified. I was absolutely mortified. I couldn't stand the idea of getting up in front of a bunch of people, you know, especially the girls, because I was shy as all get-go, and recite. So I got up and I recited the poem, and he slapped his hands together, looked at me, and he said, "You're joining the drama club." And I thought, what's drama? Because in those days, they used to actually have these things in high school. Drama clubs, chess clubs, and calligraphy clubs. You know, in the days when people still got an education, they even taught Latin, you know.
Yes.
Latin teacher. And
civics at history. One point, sure.
Yeah. There was that one time there was something called an education.
Yeah.
So he says, okay, so he wanted me to go see this play he had directed by Peter Ustinov called Romanov and Juliet. I didn't want to go. So what I did is I waited to the last 10 minutes and I snuck into the back of the theater, and I was absolutely, just so I could say, "Oh yes, Mr. Tripp, I went to the play. It was a very good play, Mr. Tripp. Thank you very much, sir." So I caught the last 10 minutes and I went, "What are these people doing?" And I was absolutely mesmerized, hypnotized by it. The next thing I know, I started to rehearse Hamlet with him. And I did my first play at 16, I played Laertes, and then I was hooked. And I was hooked on William Shakespeare. I memorized his plays. I used to carry Hamlet with me in my pocket. I used to listen to Sir John Gielgud's recording, which was done in 1937. On an old little record player, and I fell in love with William Shakespeare. It was that simple. All the plays, I just totally was mesmerized. What a world! What a universe! There I was in black and white Canada, Toronto in the freezing cold. And the other thing that happened is this little toy called television had just been created back in 1954, and I started watching in black and white live from New York. The plays, the Neighborhood Playhouse, the Playhouse 90, you know, there they were on TV, the young James Dean, Rod Steiger, Sidney Lumet directing, Patty Chayefsky writing, they were all on TV, just kids, and I coming live from New York in black and white, and I was really transfixed by it. And so I started doing plays all through high school, all through university. I ended up studying behavioral psychology. I graduated as a psychologist studying. I didn't go into electrical engineering. I studied that too, I'm sure. And so I just became more and more in love with theater. And I went to the University of Toronto and then University of Guelph, and there was a drama department. The next thing I know, I was taking that as well as the sciences, and becoming a bit of a kind of star and doing stage. And this is back in 1967, 68. And then what happened in Canada is Pierre Elliott Trudeau passed what were known as the LIP grants. These were the equivalent of the FDR, you know, the works programs that were set up by FDR that, you know, salvaged America. And that started the theater movement in Canada. And I just happened to be part of a group of people in the late 60s in Toronto. And we started doing theater. And out of that group came people like John Candy, people like Des McAnuff, who just did Jersey Boys on Broadway, Saul Rubinek, Maury Chaykin. There was just Andrea Martin, all these people, the SCTV people. That was all created. Yeah. Time.
Well, you know, I'm a huge fan of SCTV. You know, we talked about that before, but you have some fans in the chat room. Again, Chris says he knows about your career. He says you were up for the role of Indiana Jones against Tom Selleck. And he also says you were good friends with George Kennedy, Martin Landau, and Roger Corman.
I was. I met with Steven Spielberg four times. He auditioned me for the role of Raiders of the Lost Ark. He himself did the screen test on me. And he kept calling me back, and apparently I was at the top of the heap at that particular point. One day he invited me to his office, and there was a giant check for $80 million that had been given by George Lucas to Steven Spielberg, his cut of Star Wars. They had made an agreement in college that they would share in each other's success. And the next thing I know, Harrison Ford was starring in it, which he was perfect for the part. And I used to get invited to his place on Sundays. We do readings of different screenplays. He was a wonderful man, but I did not get the part. And, of course, had I gotten that part, my entire life would have probably have been over. I would have probably finished up.
Well, you probably wouldn't be talking to the likes of me if you'd got to play Indiana Jones, I'm guessing.
Well, I don't know about that. The thing is this, you know, I hated the red carpet. I was a drug addict, alcoholic, till about 1981. And then I got sober, and I've been sober 38 years. And my brain really did not function well in terms of what is known as the world of glamour. And the bullshit, I'm sorry, but that's what it is, of all that fame and nonsense, which unfortunately has become, you know, the world we live in now, man, because everybody wants that utter useless nonsense of fame and money. Fame and money are not going to make anybody happy.
Well, I want to transition to what we talked about yesterday off air, because I want you to talk about your film about the medical industrial complex and all that. But transitioning into that, what you're seeing now is, of course, you're in Paris. But if you were in L.A., Hollywood to me seems like it's dead now. It's on life support, and I, you know, again, I think they're one of the most notable.
It's a Marshall camp, as far as I'm concerned. It's a carceral city. What happened in Los Angeles, and I watched it happen when I arrived. You know, Los Angeles was still a kind of open city. I mean, yeah, it was smoggy and all that. And as the 80s happened, and basically the world was taken over, monopolized by a system that made it possible for some people to become billionaires and even trillionaires, and everybody else to go fall through the hell to hell, which is what happened in the 80s when every single policy that FDR had put in was destroyed by Ronald Reagan. allowing the creation of monopolies, which is what FDR had fought against the robber barons, resulting in the Depression and the war and all that. Well, those things were all repealed. And the city, as that happened, for the first time in my life, I started seeing homeless people on the streets of Los Angeles within 6 months of Reagan's governorship, when he became governor of California. And bit by bit, all the welfare, the safety nets of society, all that stuff were all eliminated. And the money started getting sucked up into smaller and smaller pockets until now most of the money's in the hands of about 60 men that control the entire planet. It is absurd. Middle class, working class destroyed, middle class destroyed, the unions destroyed. I saw it all happen. And L.A. kind of constricted itself into the Hollywood Hills and Beverly Hills and, security fences and all this utter nonsense, a way of living which is ridiculous. So yes, life is great for about 2% of the population.
Reflects, and Hollywood reflects that. Exactly. And now,
exactly.
Onboard Fame, my new book, which you were kind enough to write a great blurb for. I talked about the, it's astonishing what the average actor makes. It's very little, because there's lots of these.
The average actor makes under $5,000 a year.
Yeah, I mean, geez.
98% of the, and it used to be, like when I came into the business, it was really a very, for example, there was a driver that would take me to the studio, and he would work 2 hours a day, drive me there and drive me back. This guy owned 3 houses in the valley and was making $2,500 a week because the unions were very powerful. Actors would come in like myself. I think my very first job, they paid me for, I was the star of the biggest picture Columbia was doing that year, which was Nightwing, which was a huge flop. Well, Arthur Hiller, all Oscar-winning guys. I made $45,000, and then what would happen is you would go on a gradient. The next show you'd make 55 or 60 or 70, and bit by bit build, over a period of time. And actors were paid very fairly. There was a very strong middle class and upper middle class actor, and of course stars, and then superstars and legends, and each one. It reflected. But what happened was everything, now it's all or nothing. You either make 20 million or nothing. You might have 300 films to your credit, don't mean a goddamn thing. Because it's all now, it's all about basically eating hamburgers on the internet and you've got 20 million subscribers, or, you're doing makeup thing, or you're, shaking your booty and you've got 40 million subscribers. I mean, so what's happened basically is that the actual profession, the craft of actors, right, who would get paid fairly, that's all disappeared. It's all or nothing now. If, the last number of years, I was, before I got very, very ill, making my own little independent films. And what television I did do, about 15 years ago. And so, NBC, CBS, they started paying scale, nothing. And I remember a story that was told to me where this started happening about 20 years ago when this shift started to occur. It was began to manifest in the 90s. Al Pacino was doing a film and he was getting paid, I think, I don't know, $3 million or something like that to star in it. And all the other actors that were very good, fine, established character actors and so forth, suddenly are getting paid scale. Nothing. Their normal salary might have been $150,000. Instead of $150,000, they're making $10,000, et cetera. So they went to Al, and Al said, hey, pay these guys what they're worth. And the producers basically said, you pay them. And Al Pacino actually did do that. I took $1 million of his own salary and spread it evenly among all the other actors. To be fair about it, that's what started happening. Hollywood got taken over by unbelievably venomous sharks. Started happening about 85, 86. Everybody knows who they are. They took over and they monopolized. when CAA was created with Mike Ovitz and so forth, he basically monopolized the whole system. And he was the one that basically said to the studios, hey, you want this star? You got to pay him 10 times what he would normally get paid. The studios were held over a barrel. They had to pay, so they paid. And the end result was the other actors started getting all their salaries cut. It's exactly like what happened to the American worker. Until now, as I say, it's all or nothing. So so that's what happened. And it happened on, and Hollywood was the first to do that kind of stuff and turned it very rapidly into what it is now, you know, Marvel Comics, you know, $400 million films that will, you know, will make, you know, the occasional film will make $3 billion and save, you know, save Hollywood.
Well, what would Hollywood have done even before the lockdown and everything in the last couple of years? They had been running on fumes outside of the superhero films. I was astonished that that base they have of comic book people, they apparently never get tired of it. But that it seems like how much of a percent of the profits in Hollywood do you think are from these superhero movies? It must be a huge percent.
Oh, I think most of it, maybe 90%, 95%. Look, 80% of films don't even recoup their money. That's the reality. That has always been the reality of Hollywood. Hollywood, if it were like any other business, would have gone out of business a long time ago. The only reason it hasn't is because occasionally there have been films that have made so much money that it's fed everybody else. And in the old days, that money was spread out to the community, to the actors, to the character actors, to the drivers, to the ADs, to the frists, you know, and to the makeup artists and all that stuff. So it basically was able to maintain, you know, a pretty decent way of life. All that was destroyed, you know. And the other thing, too, that just like Nike shoes, you know, and everything else, everything was outsourced. So it moved in the mid-80s, Hollywood moved to Canada, where it could be done for 40% less. And they had to pay. They didn't have to pay the kinds of money they paid in Hollywood to the unions there. They had a whole new source of actors, some of whom were quite good. They didn't have to pay them anything. There was no star system in Canada. And so it was a collusionary thing between the Canadian government and Hollywood working together to basically destroy the rights and the ability of workers to continue. I started to campaign against all this stuff, and of course I was blacklisted for even attempting. But there were still people like Ed Asner and so forth, you know, really solid guys in the union that were trying to, you know, to try to reverse what is in fact an irreversible process. Because the reality is, it's like, you can't reverse it, kids. Hollywood is now owned by China, most of the money, you know, and that's just the reality. So it's all or nothing. We're in a whole new age here. Yeah, so, absolutely.
And you know, you've got a lot of interest in the chat room. But one more question about Hollywood, and then I want to transition to what we talked about yesterday. What does Mr. Mancuso think of Randy Quaid and his Star Whackers theory, which I find fascinating?
He's totally on the button.
Yeah.
I know Randy, and I haven't seen him in years. He's totally on the button. You know, what happened to Randy has happened to, as you point out, in Borrowed Fame, to thousands of people, including myself. I basically was whacked by my business manager after being with him for 33 years. And he basically, you know, did what the FBI called me, was a Chicago two-step, left me with a gigantic tax debt of over $1.5 million and no way to be able to recoup. He didn't pay it. And took a house from me and got away with it. I couldn't do anything about it. I was absolutely devastated. And that was about 15 years ago. I was so devastated and so shocked. And I'd given this guy power of attorney in 1978. I won't say who it is because I will continue to try to take legal action, even though the statute of limitations is long gone. But what happened to me was back in, 15 years ago, when this happened, I was in such shock. I was so destroyed, I started having heart attacks. And a downhill slide began in my life that basically brought me to the doors of death. Seven years ago, I was given a year to live. And 4 years ago, I had a month to live. And I have reversed all that and come back to life. And the reason I have come back to life is to tell this story and tell my story, because it's important for people to understand that this what has happened to America isn't by accident. It's not by coincidence or whatever, but it is a specific kind of agenda, a very clear agenda for power and money, which has been sucked into the pockets of maybe 60 men on planet Earth, maybe 600, the whole system. How can you have a system now where, you know, what is a national debt? 70 trillion? All they keep doing is printing money and printing money and printing money. I mean, the whole thing is like, I mean, obviously, and people are now basically, you know, the reality is, look, let's look at a very simple statistic, very simple one. At the turn of the century, last century, not this one, 50% of the population had to work in farming to feed 100% of the population, one in two persons. Now, because of the advances in technology that we've had in the last 100 years, 0.02% of the population through machinery and everything else can feed in excess of 1,000% of the population. We have an extraordinary abundance going on here. All the scarcity that exists is artificially created.
Absolutely.
Totally artificially created. And why? Because a very small coterie of the so-called coven or the cult or whatever you want to call them, the Illuminati, give them a name of some kind, the boys, basically, are running the show. Democracy means zippity-doo-dah. And the whole idea of democracy is a joke. You cannot have a democratic process if the control is through money. Baron Rothschild, you know, the founder of the Rothschild dynasty, which is $1 trillion dynasty, back in 1780, wrote, when they were starting to wrote, he said, give me control of a nation's wealth or banks, and I care not a whit which crown sits on which head.
You are well read in my area, my friend. That's
And Jefferson himself said, right, near the end of his life, the real threat to the American Republic will not come from foreign potentates. It will come from our banks. You know very well that the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, which was passed December 24th, when nobody was in there to vote, giving the right for the creation of what Jefferson tried to prevent, which was a centralized banking system.
Wow.
That was created, and it was created by who? By J.P. Morgan, by Rockefeller, by the Bushes, by all these bankers, the Rothschilds, and so forth. It's their bank. And what do they do?
Right.
They print the money, which is lent to the American government at interest. Right. At interest. And the American government has to pay it back with interest. They tax the American people. That's where the debt is. It's
It's legalized counterfeiting. Every loan that originates is created out of nothing. It's ridiculous. I mean, just imagine having that power.
it's a joke. The whole thing is a joke.
It is. Well, you've got so much knowledge there that
There's a wonderful documentary. There was a Hollywood producer that did a wonderful documentary called Freedom, From Freedom to Fascism, Aaron Russo, who produced Trading Places and The Rose, wonderful films. Near at the end of his life, he did a documentary on this very issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I found out about it, which is almost 10, 15 years ago. He has unfortunately died since then. But look, you go on the internet, you can get the facts. You can get a lot of bullshit, but you can also get a lot of real information, which has nothing to do with the, quote, official story, the so-called fake news. It's all fake news now, man. It's like, so anyway,
there's a couple more questions for you about Hollywood. Bobby wants me to ask you about your Bible movies you made, and trivia An anonymous person said that Nick has a connection with the Matrix. He made a TV series called Matrix in 1993 with Carrie Ann Moss. So you got people listening and are in the chat room that know you about your career.
Yeah, very bizarre, but I did do a series called Matrix. And in it, I played an assassin who is in turn assassinated and goes to hell. In hell, he's given a second chance to redeem himself. And he comes back to the land of the living, and he uses spirits and so forth to solve and help other people. Carrie Ann Moss, just by coincidence, was in that TV series. It only lasted 13 episodes. It was for USA Network, one of the first ones they did. And then she went off to do, strangely, one of the biggest hits, you know, Hollywood ever produced, called Matrix. It had nothing to do one with the other. Bizarre. And
how about your movies about movies about the Bible? There's an interest there.
Well, I started doing about 20 years ago. A company called Cloud 10, started by Peter and Paul Lalonde in Toronto, in Ontario, who realized there was a huge market in the Christian community. They were Christians, and they asked me to play the beast, the devil, 666. And they became huge hits. It was some of the biggest hits. We shot them for $1 million, and they made over, I don't know, $200 million. And they did three of those in the Left Behind series. It was a huge, huge company. And then it was sued, and they went bankrupt, and I never got my percentage. But I became known as the Beast among the Christian community all over the United States, because they sold, I don't know how many, 20 million units, or big, big hit. That and Black Christmas are probably the biggest hits I ever had.
Really? You know,
very strange, yes, in terms of actual financial, other than Under Siege, you know, because I also did the martial arts movies with Steven Seagal and
what about Brandon. What about Stingray? Wasn't that on for a year? Because you were the star of that, right?
Well, Stingray is a huge cult hit, you know. Mm-hmm. It lasted 24 episodes. Stingray was cursed from the get-go. You know, Steve Cannell was a dear, dear friend of mine, and I had done a pilot for him back in 1976 called Shaq. And what happened was, I was brought out to Hollywood. I was picked up out of Stratford, the theater. I was doing Shakespeare with Maggie Smith, Hume Cronin, Jessica Tandy, Jeremy Brett.
Wow.
And I had been hired by Robin Phillips to do Shakespeare. I love Shakespeare, and I was doing Merchant of Venice, Anthony and Cleopatra, Midsummer Night's Dream. You know, I was playing the young Shakespearean lovers, you know, Lysander and Bassanio, and, you know, all those kinds of characters. And I got some extraordinary reviews from the New York Times. Eleanor Kilgallen saw me, and Walter Kerr of the New York Times, who was the biggest critic in the English-speaking language, gave me two paragraphs in New York Times, saying effectively that I had eliminated the curse that had been put on the role of Bassanio for well over 250 years, which alerted Eleanor Kilgallen, head of casting at Universal. She came up, and in those days, I was offered a contract to come to Hollywood, and I said, no thanks, I'm not coming to America, because I was vehemently against the war in Vietnam at that time. And I thought, no, I ain't going to America. And she said, well, dear, if you ever change your mind. Well, what happened? Suddenly, ABC, I was making $500 a week, I think. ABC suddenly offers me $10,000 to come to Hollywood and sign an option. I thought, these Americans are crazy. So I ended up in Hollywood, and I was introduced to Stephen J. Cannell, and suddenly I'm shooting a pilot for him in 1976. And we stayed in touch years, and so I was so stupid. I was such an idiot, and still am, because I walked into Steve's office. Steve is one of I used to call him the Shakespeare of television. He was a great, great man. You know, he produced 30 years of TV hits in the 80s, starting with Beretta and Rockford Files and A-Team, Greatest American Hero, Baba Black Sheep, Hunter, the man was a genius, you know, and a great man, a truly great man, and a dear friend, God rest his soul. And I was such an idiot. I walked into his office, and I was pissed because I was under option. I had to do this pilot now. I wanted to go back to Canada to do Loveborg and Had a Gambler. That was for the CBC, because I wasn't what they referred to as an actor. You know, I didn't want to do some stupid television show. So I walked into Steve's office, and Steve says to me, "So, what'd you think of the script?" I said, "It sucks." And he looks at me. Now, this guy had already done Rockford Files. He had already done these great shows. He looked at me and said, "You're right. It does suck. Come and write." So I wrote with Steve for 2 weeks, and we improvised. And just say, "What if, what if, what if?" And we're like kids, you know, just playing. And because that's what it is. You know, acting is children's games with adult rules. And Steve was a beautiful soul, a great child, you know, spirit. So we created that pilot, and that became, years later, became Stingray. Stingray was based on what we had both improvised. Now, when Steve told me about Stingray, I said, absolutely not. I don't want to do a TV show. I was doing films in those days, 2 to 3 films a year. And he said, "Oh, look, he says, you know, I met him in New York. I'd been in Europe, in France, actually, shooting a film. And I suddenly says, look, I said, I can't stand these goddamn TV shows. You know, freeze, you know. Motherfucker, freeze, you know. Get a gun, freeze." So I went, you know, and he said, no, man, no gun, you know, no screeching tires, no guns, no screeching tires. It's going to be characters. It's going to be characters, you know. And it was based on things. So I decided to do it. Okay, fine, you know. So we did. Started shooting it, and we do the pilot, and you know, and I had fun doing it, and you know, and we're supposed to do 22 episodes, and NBC is supposed to do it. And Steve calls me up and he says, "Hey, man, I got bad news. You know, it ain't going to happen. They tested it. It tested shitty." They do the pilot. What they used to do is they'd make a pilot, you know, and then they would test it in preview houses. And they get audiences with little dials and they pull to the right and left, tell them, you know, they would get a number. It was called a TVQ. So then they would pump it into 60,000 homes in the old days of the Nielsen ratings, right? They tested average. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know. Mm-hmm. So NBC said, "Look, you know, we don't want to do it." So Steve called me up and said, "You know, it's got to be canceled." And I said, "Okay." And it was a pay or play. It was supposed to pay me a huge amount of money. And I said, "It's okay, you don't have to pay me," because I'm such an idiot. But anyway, a week before it opens, the reviews come out, and the reviews are glowing. USA Today, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, television at its best. And he says, "Well, let's see how it does." Well, Sunday night it airs. It takes the year. Got a 42 share. Huge. And NBC goes, "Wow, what's this?" So they decide to order it. So the next thing you know, we're scrambling like crazy trying to get 13 episodes done. And it was one thing after another. One thing after another. Long and the short of it is we did the first 24. It was doing really well in the ratings. And then it looked like, it was ordered for a second season. And next thing you know, they pulled it. Why? Michael Mann, who was doing Crime Story and Miami Vice, had a new show. They needed a time slot. We were the new kids on the block. They pulled us, boom, put in that show. We were getting 24s. That show got 12s and 13s. 2 years later, they come back to me and they say, "We made a huge mistake. It was a hit. It was a hit. We need to reorder it." You know, and I couldn't because I was doing Matrix, and I couldn't get it.
Well, I would say, but when I've ever mentioned your name, I think that's Stingray is what probably pops in a lot of people's heads first. Yeah, because you were the star of it and everything. And I, you know, we're running gosh, there's you have so much information that I don't want to ask you if you can't, but do you want to stay for the second hour? Because we've got tons of stuff to talk about. If you can't, I understand. We'll wind it down. Well, that's great. Then we can. So yeah, because people are obviously interested in your Hollywood career. You've got someone here says, did Nick know Belushi or Freddie Prinze in the JFK assassination? Which I've written about. Both of those guys were very interested in JFK.
I worked with Jim Belushi. I mean, with his brother,
John Belushi.
I worked with the brother of Jim Belushi. What's his name?
Well, John Belushi is the one that died. You worked with him, the one from Saturday Night Live?
No, I didn't work with him.
You worked with Jim. Jim was his brother. Okay.
Yeah, his brother had for a while there was a big name, and he starred in a miniseries that Oliver Stone produced called Wild Palms.
Yes.
Which was strangely enough, one of the directors that we had three directors was Catherine Bigelow, who won the Oscar for Hurt Locker.
Yes.
And Keith Gordon was the other director, and we had all kinds of actors in it, including Robert Loggia, Kim Cattrall, Belushi, Angie Dickinson, right. I played with Angie Dickinson. You know, she was a legend, and there were a lot of really good actors, and Oliver Stone, and I played this crazy it was set in this bizarre kind of world of the future, you know, where the city of Los Angeles had been taken over by Scientologists, you know, and these bizarre events were occurring and strange science fiction stuff. And it was actually a really interesting project, you know. I mean, it was really kind of fascinating, very, very imaginative. Bruce Wagner, that was the writer, and based on a cartoon or something. But I did work with him, but I did not know John Belushi. I didn't meet him, but he did die at the old famous Chateau Marmont, where I used to stay in between marriages.
Well, you know, since I wrote on Borrowed Fame, I wish it didn't get in the book, but I found that. I think it's thanks Chris, who's in the chat room. Chris is probably the one that sent it to me. I have several people: Chris Graves, Peter Seacosh, Bob Wilson, who's also in the chat room. These guys are the best researchers in the world. They send me so much information, you know, makes it a lot easier. But they sent me something that Dick Gregory, who I admired very much, wrote, where he talked about John Belushi calling him the night before he died and saying, I need to talk to Mark Lane, who, you know, I got my start volunteering as a teenager for Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry, my hero. I said, I want to talk to Mark Lane about the JFK assassination. Next day he dies. Pretty bizarre, you know, and I always look for those kind of connections when I hear about these deaths. And the guy mentioned Freddie Prinze in Hidden History, I talked about, is that when I was a teenager with Mark Lane's group, I was in Mark Lane's office and I was so giddy about meeting him and talking to him. And, you know, Rush to Judgment was, you know, one of my Bibles as a kid and as a teenager. And he got up the phone and started talking to us about talking to Freddie Prinze, you know, who at that time was the hottest comedian in Hollywood, Chico and the Man.
He was.
And he says, you know, this guy, he says he's obsessed with the JFK assassination. He's watching the Zapruder film all the time. He wants to do a telethon and said he's calling me every day. So I didn't think that much of it, but like literally a month or two later is when he supposedly killed himself. They had one of those Lifetime movies, The Last Days of Freddie Prinze, which concentrated on the drugs like they did with Belushi.
Not one word
about the JFK assassination, which I know for a fact he was utterly obsessed with. And Steve Ubaney, who's written some great books, he was a guest a few weeks back on here, he told me, again, I didn't know until after On Borrowed Fame had already gone to the publisher, that Elvis, much like Freddie Prinze, Elvis Presley used to watch his copy. He learned it from Sonny West, you know, a member of the Memphis Mafia, that Elvis was sitting around watching the Zapruder film all the time. So I always get suspicious with these deaths in Hollywood that, hey, you know, this is a JFK thing, 9/11 thing or whatever. I don't know. But I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, I mean, there is no question that there are some nefarious forces operating. And by the way, 'twas ever thus.
Right.
You know, I come from Italy, where a tremendous amount of blood has over the years has flooded, and Europe too. By the way, here in Paris, the streets of Paris were flowing in blood, and only 80 years ago, the Nazis were pulling the Jews out of the apartments, and partisans were being shot against walls. You could still see the bullet holes in the École Militaire, where Napoleon. So Europe is bathed, and I was born in Europe. America was not. America, the blood of America, of course, was all Indian. America committed the greatest genocide in human history. Well over 80 million American Indians were murdered over a 100-year period. This is a fact. Tom Hayden, who was a friend of mine and was part of the Chicago Eight, you know, the senator, he was married to Jane Fonda and was one of the great political thinkers of America. He wrote a book called American Apocalypse, and he argued, and I agree with him, that until America makes restitution to the North American Indian, America will always be bathed in blood. America is bathed in blood. America, the blood of America is self-sacrificing and cannibalistic. There are 42,000 handgun deaths in America every year. Something is seriously wrong. Something is seriously, seriously wrong. Getting back to nefarious forces, there are nefarious forces. The Romans knew that. Why do you think they crucified Jesus Christ? I mean, what do you think this is all about, kids? Why was Socrates forced to take poison? You know, why was Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinated? And, of course, John F. Kennedy. Of course, you know, and of course it's not what, you know. It's like my country. My country was destroyed. And everybody thinks it was because we were, just poor people, those poor Southern Italian peasants. They were unified. Italy was unified. And they have pizza pie and they play the accordion. And isn't it wonderful? And everybody's so happy. It was 1.5 million people were murdered in the 1870s. It was mass genocide. There were mass graves outside of Naples, 2,000 bodies. They had the very first concentration camps in Europe, where Southern Italians and Sicilians in the north, before, back in 1890. And you can see photographs. They would decapitate people and put their heads on stakes, put them inside of glass boxes. I've seen photos of this. All this is in a book called I Savoia, Il Sacro del Sud.
Well, there's so many. You're talking about Italian history, which I don't know much about, but just it's amazing how many historical crimes and atrocities happen that get forgotten about, swept under the rug. That's why I said, you know, I don't know how anybody can believe anything other than a supernatural force, a god, could possibly ever straighten out, because there's so much there and so much we don't know about. How many crimes happen, awful things, and people get away with it, groups get away with it. It's astonishing what mankind does to each other.
Well, you know, the Scientologists believe that this is a prison planet. They believe that this planet, planet Earth, is where they send all the criminals and the psychopaths of the universe to serve their time. The ancient Hindus believed, of course, that there are these bodhisattvas or these avatars that come here to help us, you know, to awaken. Because the reality is, until we awaken to our true natures, which has got to be love and compassion and tolerance and all those things, we're screwed. So this is where we work out the karma. You know, and ain't it dramatic? You know, ain't it a dramatic venue? So you want to talk theater? Look around you. It's all around us, you know. So we're in the process. This is the great university of the cosmos. This is where everybody comes to learn. And unfortunately, pain is a signpost of spiritual growth. I mean, there's a reason why the great avatar is on a crucifix, you know. There's a reason why these images exist. You know, it isn't coincidence. So getting back to these stories of, you know, assassinations and so forth, but no doubt, obviously, that, you know, I mean, come on now. Let's use our little bit of thinking here. Buildings fall at 0.06 seconds with the speed of gravity.
Sure.
And do buildings suddenly accidentally collapse for having a little bit of fire fall on their rooftop? Come on, guys. Does Kennedy's head snap back in the Magruder film? Come on.
Well, Nick, let me ask you, because you're so awake, what we call awake in my world, the conspiracy world. How, you know.
Just don't call me woke.
Yeah, no, we don't want to be
woke. Awake, but
yeah, awake. No, we don't. The woke or the sleepest, you know, they are comatose. But now we're awake. We're actually aware.
Eyes wide shut.
Exactly. But once you became awake, or you started knowing, you said learn about Rothschild and everything about 15 years ago or whatever it was. What did you start trying to talk to your actor friends or your industry friends? Do you know, what's the feeling in Hollywood? Are more people actually out there understanding the extent of the corruption, and there are lots of conspiracies and they're just afraid to talk, and there's only a few bold ones that will speak out here or there?
I think, I have not really encountered too many. I think what happens is this. When you undergo a severe trauma, like I did, it starts to wake you up. Because what happens is there's a comfortable, first of all, if you're an actor in particular, you're struggling to get to the top and stay on the top, or as Sue Mengers used to say to me at ICM, the problem isn't getting to the top. The problem is staying on top. It is a highly competitive business. So most people are just wrapped up in that. I have always by nature been inquisitive, just the nature of my mind. So I try to understand things. I told you my original interest was science. I wanted to know how the universe worked. Mm-hmm. So if you use your eyes, let him that hath ears hear, and let him that hath eyes see. Simply observe. It was like Galileo looks at the pendulum, swinging, and realizes, hey, wait a minute. Now, this movement, it's balanced. There's something going on here. What is going on here? Newton is supposedly under an apple tree, and an apple hits him on the head. What is going on? What is this force called gravity? Oh, gee, let me look through this telescope. There's mountains on the moon. What? Oh, yes, the Earth is going around the sun, not the other way around. Oh, that's absolute nonsense, says the church. But listen, all you need to do is just look through the telescope. You can see it. Cardinal, what's his name, looks through the telescope and says to Galileo, I see nothing. Either shut up or we're going to pull out your eyes. They were going to actually put out his eyes. They burned Giordano Bruno at the stake. They burned Savonarella, etc. Twas ever thus. So it's like, it's like you don't want to get too close to the truth, because if you get too close to the truth, they might take off your head. So what is it going to take? It's going to take a certain kind of courage and a certain kind of awareness.
Hold that thought, Nick, because we got to go to commercial break. We only have one commercial break. We're going to go for this, and you're going to stay for the second hour, and I'm very honored for that. So we'll be right back after these words with more of the great Nick Mancuso.
In a time of fake news, fake politicians, and fake fiat currency, it's getting harder to find the genuine article. That's why when it comes to precious metals, I call the team I can trust. This is David Knight from my friends at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange. Proudly veteran-owned and operated, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange is your home for gold and silver coins, bullion, jewelry, and more. Prices and inventory are updated daily, so you get the most competitive possible pricing. And when it's time to sell your gold and silver items, they pay top dollar. Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange also accepts and deals in Bitcoin. Call or text the owner, Tony Arterburn, today at 888-667-1836. That's 888-667-1836. 877-867-1836. Or just go to wisewolf.gold. From bullion to Bitcoin, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Revelation through conversation.
Hi there, this is John Barber, and you're listening to the most informed man in America, my friend, fellow author, and raconteur, the great Donald Jeffries Show.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Hi, this is Ron Paul. You're listening to The Donald Jeffries Show.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Ocelli.com.
Donald Jeffries Show.
And welcome back to the Donald Jeffries Show. We're talking with the great Nick Mancuso, just one of the most incredible guys. I mean, I love talking to him for talk about so many subjects. Now, we pretty much covered Hollywood. Well, first of all, I want to tell we are opening the phone line, so if you'd like to talk to Nick or me, or whatever, the number is 319-527-5016. Again, 319-527-5016. So, Nick, I want to make sure we get to what we talked about yesterday. Was fascinating. You know, I told you about my brother and what I've been experiencing. And you started talking about your own experiences with the medical industrial complex and your film. I'm really interested in the film that you're trying to make. So you want to talk about all that? That was fascinating stuff.
Well, first of all, I want to extend my condolences to you about the death of your brother.
Thank you.
It's very, very tragic. And in my mind, avoidable.
Yes.
I got involved in this whole medical thing because of my many, many illnesses, and I will explain. About 20 years ago, I, in the middle of all this financial ripoff and bankruptcy and destruction by my business manager who stole all my money and left me destitute, and the destruction of my marriage consequently, and this man utterly ripped my guts out. In the middle of all that, I started having heart attacks. Now, I, at that time, for many, many years, have been involved in various forms of medicine. The reason being is that when I was about 20, 21, I was basically a very healthy guy, had a lot of energy. Other than, as I said, in those days, I did a lot of drinking and, you know, the 60s and all that shit. But I was a strong guy, didn't have problems with health. I started working in a theater called Toronto Free Theater back in Toronto back in 69 when we started these theaters. And what this theater was an abandoned factory the city of Toronto gave to us for $1 a year during the period of time when Pierre Elliott Trudeau created what were known as the LIP grants, or, which were similar to the works programs FDR did, and made it possible to create theaters. But there were no theaters. So we took over abandoned factories and church basements and so forth, you know, and started to put in seats and lights and write plays. And out of that group came people like Michael Ondaatje, you know, who did The English Patient, and Des McAnuff, who did Jersey Boys on Broadway, and Tommy and Big, you know, and all kinds of, you know, extraordinary talents just happened to be collected. But anyway, while I was there, and in fact, during the period of time that I was doing the collected works of Billy the Kid by Michael Ondaatje, I was playing Billy, I collapsed. I got very, very sick, and I started having all kinds of problems. I couldn't walk. I had an arthritic thing, my stomach. I was vomiting. I was all kinds of stuff. And I started going to doctors, and they started saying, well, you know, liver is like this and that, the kidneys are this, and the blood. I didn't understand what the hell was going on. And I got to a point, I was 21, I said, well, you know, am I going to die? And they said, well, we don't know. We don't know what's happening. So I started to look into other doctors, and I ended up walking into the office of a homeopathic doctor by the name of Dr. McLaren. And as I walked, who was 85 at the time, and I walked into his office, he took one look at me and he said, do you have diabetes in your family? And I said, yeah, my father. And he said, well, you're pre-diabetic. Sit down. And he gave me some homeopathic remedies. And within 6 months, it was actually Valeriana. And within 6 months, my system was stabilized and I was able to work again. And I wasn't exactly 100% healthy, but, you know, I was still very, very strong. But I was very sensitive to any kind of pollution, any kind of toxicity. You know, we are surrounded by toxicity. We live in an incredibly toxic world, thanks to petroleum and all the other shit that is out there. Our foods are full of shit and, you know, preservatives, all this crap. And people are getting sick left, right, and center. Now, most human beings today are living what is a call I would refer to as a palliative life. Palliative meaning that they are just fending off constant cancers, diabetes, MS, all kinds of stuff. And there's a reason for it. I discovered the reasons in the process of getting ill. So about 20 years ago, I was shooting a film in Czechoslovakia in an old castle, and I was doing King Arthur or something, and it was a comedy, and we were shooting in this very old castle, not far from Chernobyl, in that area there, and I was shooting in a place where there was a lot of bat guano and, you know, it had been opened up. Anyway, I got this weird flu while I was there. And it got worse and worse, and it wouldn't go away. And so when I went back to L.A., I went to my doctor, and doctor discovered that I was 100% diabetic. Blood sugars through the roof. So I went, what the hell's going on? So it started. The diseases started. The diabetes got worse and worse and worse. And then the next thing I know, I developed Hashimoto disease. And then from Hashimoto disease, bit by bit, I started having heart attacks and circulatory problems, etc., etc. And I started going blind, and all sorts of wonderful things started to occur. I began to do a lot of research as to what the hell was going on, and I ended up in the offices of some of the finest doctors really on the planet, one of whom is Dr. Julian Whitaker in California of the Whitaker Institute. At his clinic, which unfortunately no longer exists, there was a space-age technology, medical technology, that came from NASA. This guy was one of the most brilliant doctors in America. And he examined my blood and discovered that I had very heavy metals in my blood, including lead, mercury, cadmium. Now, that was not a surprise. What was a surprise, however, is that he discovered I had uranium-235 in my bloodstream. He called me to his office. He asked me if I worked in the nuclear industry. I said, no. He said, you have uranium-235 in your bloodstream. Where in God's name would you get that? Big mystery. And he gave me a protocol that I was able to eliminate most of the toxic material. I had to go and I had to sweat, well, one of which is called EDTA chelation, which are IV drips, where a certain substance is introduced into the bloodstream. It was actually developed by German scientists to deal with mustard gas poisoning. It pulls out these heavy metals. I did many sessions. I had money at the time. Thank God I could do that. And the other was I had to do a sweat protocol. I had to sweat 5 hours a day for 64 days straight with massive doses of vitamins, including niacin, at 5,000 units, started at 50 all the way to 5,000. Niacin, if you take it at 500, will cause your whole body to break out in like redness. It expands the capillaries. There you get very itchy on it and stuff, and it causes toxins to get pulled out of your body. So I ended up doing this. That basically saved my life. But this mystery, where would I get this uranium? Just by coincidence, shortly after I did this protocol, which was the beginning of the salvation and at the same time the destruction of my health, because my health kept going downhill, but slower, I was invited back to Toronto to do an anniversary production of the collected works of Billy the Kid by Michael Ondaatje, music by Des McAnuff from Jersey Boys, and all these famous people that went on to become famous, by the Governor General of Canada and 400 invited guests, a very kind of she occasion. And I was brought in and I went back to that theater that I helped to found in 1969, 35 years later. And I walk in and it's all glass and brick and pine. It's just beautiful. You know, they did a terrific job because it became a famous theater. And I said to the artistic director, Martin Bragg, my God, it's a palace. When we were here, it was a dump. And Martin told me, when you guys were here, it was a toxic dump. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, 4 years after you left the original group, City of Toronto closed it down for a year, for almost a year, and removed barrels of PCPs, dioxins, lead, mercury, that were buried in the ground, and the soil was radioactive. I went, oh, this is what happened. Another strange occurrence was that I met a Professor Van Wyck, Peter Van Wyck, who happened to be the brother of an old girlfriend of mine from university. Who's a professor at somewhere in the States. And this man had written a book called Highway of the Atom. Highway of the Atom documents how it was that the actual bomb, the atom bomb, was not created in the United States. It was actually created in Canada. The original pitch blend from which radium is made was mined in Great Slave Lake, British Columbia, shipped across the country to Port Hope, Ontario, and secret sites in Toronto and some in Montreal, laboratories where the radium was converted into uranium-235, then shipped down to Los Alamos. And in fact, that was the uranium that was used for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This theater, in quotation marks, was one of those secret sites. So that was the beginning of the end of the mystery of what had happened to me. The consequence of that was that my body was severely damaged. One thing led to another. Diabetes to Hashimoto to finally congestive heart failure, heart attacks, open heart surgery, and then autoimmune hepatitis. And as of 4 years ago, I had 1 month to live. Now, 7 years ago, I was in Toronto in hospitals, and basically my sister was told I had a year to live. And a series of very interesting things occurred. One was, I kept working, and I kept trying, going to doctors, and I ended up with some amazing doctors. One was Dr. Julian Whitaker, another one was a Dr. Bernard Frotzheim in Germany, a Dr. Radulescu, a Romanian biochemist in Toronto, and many, many other naturopathic healers and doctors and so forth. I started to study many forms of medicine, not just homeopathic, but Ayurvedic and of course, Chinese medicine and acupuncture and electromagnetic and so forth. And I, 4 years ago, like I said, I ended up, while I was working on this bizarre film, the last of the films, I started to produce these films. I ended up in Taiwan, where I collapsed, and ended up at the McKay Hospital with a Dr. Su, one of the top vascular surgeons in that part of the world, by coincidence. Dr. Su told me that I had about 6 hours to live. I was going into septic shock. And in spite of having been in hospitals, you know, in Toronto, far, they did nothing, absolutely nothing. Destiny took me to Taiwan. Just turns out to be that Taiwan is the number one medical center in the world. South Korea is number two. United States of America is number 45. Canada used to be 12. It's now number 28. By chance, I ended up in the hands of a man that saved my life. By a series of coincidences, just before, I ended up here in France. France is number 4 or 5. And I met my current wife, who introduced me to all these healers and doctors. And basically, I have been more or less restored to health.
Well, you sound great, but I mean, I can't help but thinking, much as I said about my brother, if he'd never gone to the hospital, he'd be alive today. The way you make it sound, if you had elected to go,
if I'd stayed in Canada, I would have been dead, because you see, there is socialized medicine. I got involved with all this. I wouldn't use the word bullshit, okay?
Right.
Because the great majority of what we refer to as modern medicine is bullshit.
Yeah, it's slash and burn. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's basically emergency medicine. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. There is a tremendous amount of positive in it, no question about it. But it's emergency medicine. It's a medicine for bullet wounds. It's for crisis management. It is not for healing.
Exactly. Okay?
It is not for chronic diseases like cancer, diabetes, fibromyalgia, et cetera, Alzheimer's, all these diseases that have popped in. They will not heal you. Diabetes, for example. You know, the way I discovered my first heart attack was I was put on glyburides. That's what they do with diabetics. First thing they do is they put you on glyburides. Now, glyburides, no, and I didn't trust any of this stuff because I was doing naturopathic systems. Glyburides will cause heart attacks. It's a little side effect. Now, I took it, and I started feeling my blood sugars went down, of course. I asked the doctor, I said, how do glyburides work? And he said, well, he says, you know, the pancreas, you know, doesn't produce enough insulin. It stimulates the pancreas to produce more insulin. And I said to him, well, isn't that like beating a dead horse? Because if you have diabetes, your pancreas is very, very weak. And you're going to beat it some more to produce more insulin. But I said, okay, we'll try it. I ended up in Russia shooting a film. I was on a day off, and I was a jogger in those days. That's the other thing, too, is I got into all kinds of systems, yoga, macrobiotics, all kinds of systems for healing. And I was a jogger, and I went for a jog, thank God I was with a neighbor. And next thing I know, I'm passing out. And I almost go into a coma. Thank God this man had enough money for a Coca-Cola. My blood sugars had dropped through the roof. The way diabetics die is insulin. And some of these drugs, like glyburides, will cause sudden drops. You go into a coma, you pass out, and then you have a heart attack and you die. And that's where I was at. Thank God he got the Coke. That saved me. I went back to Toronto, went to the doctor, and I said, listen, something is seriously wrong here. And he said, well, you know, there's no thing. And I said, I'm getting stabbing pains everywhere in the body and weird shit. It was like, well, he's looking through his book. There's no evidence of this kind of side effects. And the next day, I have a massive heart attack, and I almost died. Wow. I recovered. Then I started doing all my research on the glyburides. Well, Jesus, wouldn't you know it, the University of Miami had done research in the 1970s showing that glyburides increase heart attacks 500% and identified the enzymatic action that prevents oxygen from bonding with the heart muscle, thereby causing the heart attack. Did they take glyburides off the market? No. The benefits outweighed the risk. The benefits outweigh the risk. So I realized I was really dealing with complete horse shit. You ask a doctor what the number one killer of type 2 diabetics is, and they'll say heart attacks. And if you ask the doctor why do they die of heart attacks, they'll say, oh, diabetes. And then if you ask the same idiot why it is that insulin-dependent diabetics die at the same rate as the general population, they'll say, again, oh, diabetes. It is a moronic system. As Dr. Whitaker explained to me, when he, in 2 weeks' time, was able to heal me for that period of time, unfortunately, at that time I had money, I couldn't go back to him because it was costing me $25,000 a week at that time. And when I went to his office and I said, my God, you've cured me, and I was cured at that time. I was completely normal. Magnesium drips, EDTA chelation, hyperbaric. They had technology that NASA developed. Hey, what happens if an astronaut has a heart attack in space? And they figured out what to do. They had the technology. And I said, my God, Dr. Whitaker, you've got to tell the world. You know, and he laughed and he said, don't you think I've tried? Don't you understand? He said, by the time a medical student is in first year, the pharmaceutical companies own you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, what do you, I mean, I personally think that obviously they, I mean, how is Henry Kissinger possibly alive? He's almost 100 years old. He's been obese for 40 years at least. I don't think there's ever been an obese person that old. I firmly believe, David Rockefeller lived to be 99, that there's some kind of secret technology they're not giving to the public, because if Henry Kissinger can be alive, so many people that died 40, 50 years when they were younger than that, 40, 50 years younger than him, should be alive as well. But I mean, the system is utterly corrupt, as you know.
Completely. I mean, Rockefeller lived to be 100 because he'd had 9 heart transplants. You know, and there's stem cell technology. There is all kinds of technologies that exist that the general public will never have access to. And the reason they won't is because all the bullshit, insurance scams, combined with the medical system, the whole thing's a racket, basically. It's just a racket. And what is the racket? There's no money in health, kids. There's only money in disease. The sicker you are, the more money they make. What they basically do is develop drugs that will kill you as slow as possible.
Right.
Usually. Sometimes they screw up. Normally, they wait till about 50,000 people are killed. Then they take the drug off the market, change the label, change a molecule or two, and return it back into the market. You know, I worked with an MP in Canada, Terrence Young. His daughter, Vanessa, was killed by a drug for acne or stomach problems. Like he thought it was like Rolaids. This damn thing killed his daughter, Vanessa. And he started doing research and discovered that the drug had been killing people. It was taken off the market and reordered under a different name. He sued Health Canada. He sued the company. He managed to pass the Vanessa Bill in Parliament, you know, a protection group, a citizens protection group, et cetera, et cetera. But you see, it's all about the money, kids. He who has the money has the control. The biggest lobby in Washington and Ottawa is pharmaceuticals. They make trillions. If you don't think that doesn't control everything, and the doctors are all brainwashed. I mean, even here in France, where they have some brilliant doctors, and I've been so blessed because I've had the most extraordinary doctors. I'd be dead if they weren't around. Even here, I can see the difference in some of the hospitals where the students come out, and they're totally brainwashed. You know, they'll say, how come you're not in the beta blockers? And they're this, whereas my cardiologist would say, are you crazy? Beta blockers in your condition? Absolutely not. In Canada, they were trying to force me to take beta blockers. You got to take the goddamn beta blockers. Mm. But then in Canada, what they were doing was, when I was in hospitals, they'd show up, five doctors, oh, Mr. Mancuso, could you sign this, please? Basically, gave them the right to kill me. And I said, oh, no, thank you.
Well, you're knowledgeable about this. You're passionate about it. You have experience in it.
I started making a film about it called Selling
Sick. Yes, talk about that.
Just before my collapse, what I started doing is I started doing interviews and itemizing the people that had died. Of that original group at Toronto Free Theatre, there were 42 of us. 39 are dead with an average lifespan of 59 years. Well, 25 years below the national average. I know personally at least 200 or 300 people that died.
That's like the John Wayne movie that we've heard about, right?
Exactly. He was exposed to radiation, right? He was exposed. That's what gave him the cancer when he was in Nevada shooting in a radioactive area.
And all the cast, Agnes Moorehead. I mean, I think all of them did. I think
Of course. So that's what happened to them. So I started doing this particular film, and I started filming myself as I was dying. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, I talk into the camera and all that. I've got the footage still, but I collapsed completely. I've been ill. It's taken me almost 5 years, 6 years to come back to life. Now that I'm back, you know, I'm trying to get, you know, find the funding and try to get it finished and tell the story, because I want to dedicate this to the people that died, and I want people to know what the truth is. You know, and of course, you know, it's going to be really hard because, you know, trying to get the information out there. It's like, you know, guys like David Icke or you know, Dr. Stephen Greer, you know, who's behind the whole UFO disclosure thing, or Moulton Howe, you know, and who the UFO thing, then all of which is real. You know, it's all covered up, and you know, and nobody, you know, everybody buys into the bullshit, and you know, eyes wide shut, kids. That's what we're looking at. So it's going to be a difficult process, but I will want, you know, two things I want to do before I croak is, one is tell this story, and the other is I want to get that business manager that did what he did to me,
right. And go,
you know, because I am a Sicilian.
Well, that's got to, and you know, that's was I didn't have that done to me, but I that was a basis for my inspiration on Borrowed Fame, came from Spanky McFarlane and so many others, that just, whether it was like your case, an unscrupulous manager, which happens way too often, and or just the industry that just, you know, the Hal Roaches of the world that become incredibly wealthy and they pay the performers almost nothing, and then they sell these products to, you know, for endless reruns, and the actors get no residuals. I mean, that's
no.
I just think that's terribly unfair.
Unfair. That's funny. You're a funny guy, Donald. Funny guy. Yeah, you make me laugh. I amuse you, and you think I'm funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. It's a tremendous injustice. But then, yes. You know, look at the world. I mean, you know, the story of one of the great playwrights was Samuel Beckett, who wrote Endgame and Waiting for Godot. These are classics in the theater. And, you know, and in one of the plays, a man goes to a tailor and he wants to get a suit made for him. So the tailor says, let me take your measurements. Come back in a week. And he comes back in a week and he takes more measurements. And he says, well, sir, come back in 2 weeks. And comes back in 2 weeks. He does more measurements. And the tailor says, well, come back in a month. And so he comes back in a month and he takes more measurements. And he says, come back in 3 months. And finally, the guy says, sir, God created the world in 7 days and you can't make a suit in 7 months. And the tailor says, yes, but look at the world and look at my suit. Yeah. The other one I like the most is the one where Ham and Clove, you know, Ham is covered in blood, his hand handkerchief, and he keeps telling this story. And Clove is wandering around. The stage are all kind of blind and screwed up. And Ham says to Clove, he says, well, I was telling this story. Where was I? Oh, yes, there he was, down on his knees, glaring at me with his mad eyes in defiance of my wishes. Well, I said to him, what do you want? He said, I wanted to have bread for him and the little child as well. Bread? But I have no bread. Oh, true, I have corn in my granaries. And here comes the great line. But you're on Earth. There's no cure for that.
Prison planet. Oh, that's right. I mean, that's, you know, and the great Charles Fort. I think he was the first one to say that way back when.
Lunatic asylum of the universe is what George Bernard Shaw called it. So
yes. I mean, there's a lot of, and that's what basically, yeah, Charles Fort speculated that maybe we're some kind of a zoo, we were property, you know, being observed by people.
Well, so. There was actually, you know, the Anunnaki and all the ancient, you know, there was our theories, for example, in the Sumerian tablets that apparently, you know, we are actually. That we were actually created, modulated, you know, as we were apes that had DNA changed by these alien beings known as the Anunnaki or the gods, as they were called, to become slaves for their, because they were apparently mining gold or something like that. And then we kind of got out of control a little bit, what Elon Musk is talking about with AI, right? The artificial intelligence thing that he says is a greater threat than the nuclear bomb, because AI could actually become for real, take control of the planet, just like Isaac Asimov's book I, Robot.
Yeah,
you know,
they haven't watched a bunch of old movies or read science fiction stories when they're this push for AI. I mean, it never turns out well. Apparently, they didn't see those films or read those books.
They don't need to, nor do they want to, because it's part of an agenda. Why do you think they want to go back to Mars? Mars was at one time, you're going to laugh, our home. You know, there's an asteroid belt that exists between Mars and Jupiter, a gigantic asteroid belt, billions of fragments. They believe that that was a planet at one time, that it was hit by some kind of comet or another planet or something like that when worlds collide, which was a theory by a Russian scientist and so forth.
Right, Velikovsky, sure, yeah.
Yeah, Velikovsky, and that destroyed Mars, that Mars actually had oceans and civilization before it was destroyed. The beings that were living there came to Earth. And in the Zimbabwe legends, the Zulus talk about the landing sites. What's weird is that in Zimbabwe, from the air, there were hundreds of thousands of these circles, a little bit like what's found in Peru, except, you know, they're birds, hummingbirds, and it can only be seen from the air. To say nothing of the maps of Piraeus, which show Antarctica, going back to 1520, these maps were used. It shows Antarctica under the ice when Antarctica was only discovered 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. So something is clearly amiss. We're not getting the full picture, kids, you know. And there are people out there like Dr. Stephen Greer, like Graham Hancock. Mm-hmm. There are many, many people out there that are waking up. And this control system that we're involved in, well, it's part of a big agenda, much bigger agenda that I think that, you know, we can know about. Whether, in fact, you know, Ike is right about reptile beings, you know, that have taken over sort of the bodies of the so-called leaders of the Illuminati. But there's no question that there are people on this earth that are absolutely psychopaths. No question about it.
Right.
That have absolutely no humanity or sympathy for other human beings. And basically, hey, if they can get away with it, they will.
One of my heroes, my greatest hero of all time, is still Huey Long. I wrote a whole chapter on him in Survival of the Richest. Huey said that not only is it these, it's not enough for these people to take from others and know, you know, to want everything. They have to also know, it's important to them to know that you don't have it. You know, they get off on the fact that, you know, not only did they have something, but they like the fact that you don't have it. And I think that's why so many people, they get upset, like, even if they've got everything, if somebody has something they don't think they should have, well, how does he have that big screen TV? You know, I think that's part of human nature, but the elite don't want us to have everything. And just if you're looking at what's happening in your area out there, in your former area in L.A. and San Francisco, if you look at the condition of the cities there, I mean, I can't help thinking, you know, that's got a Mad Max overtone to it. And is that the future of America, that there's just crap in the streets everywhere, tent cities? I mean, nobody's doing anything about it.
I got to tell you, man, it's very, very bizarre. Many years ago, I ended up, you know, I've studied many things over the years. I studied yoga for almost 25 years. I was an adept in the studies in the lineage of Paramahansa Yogananda, one of the great souls of our time, wrote a book called Autobiography of a Yogi. I studied Aikido, which is a martial art that was founded by Ushiba Sensei Morai, which Steven Seagal, with whom I worked at a bunch of times, was absolutely one of the best students, first white guy to actually study it and teach it. And I've been around all this stuff, but I ended up at one particular point studying with a professor, Lin Yun, a Tibetan master. And just by coincidence, it was really weird. I can't really talk about it in public because it's very hard to explain. But Dr. Liu explained that based upon the readings that these Tibetan masters have, that America was basically going to be turned into a third world country. And that was almost 25, 30 years ago. And that is precisely what seems to be occurring and happening.
Yeah, so the world's wealthiest banana republic. I mean, we are an absolute joke. We can't call third world. I mean, the fact that we have so much money, you know, the other third world countries don't have anywhere near the kind of wealth we have. But it's allocated in such ridiculous ways. I mean, you have, you know, roads and bridges collapsing everywhere, power grids that are outdated, and nobody's doing anything about it. Instead, they just keep wanting to funnel money into their own pockets, basically.
That's basically what has occurred. Absolutely. That's basically what is occurring. And you know, the problem, as I see it, is that until we can sort of clear up our brains, and, you know, America consumes well over 80% of the world's painkillers. and represents under 6% of the population. The more prescription drugs are consumed by Americans than anywhere else. How in God's name, until the health of America is restored, truly restored, how in God's name can America be restored? You know, we have to absolutely have sovereignty in our own nation. When 80% of the topsoil has been destroyed basically by pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers and all that stuff, how can it change? How can anything change?
Population is largely is more and more obese or overweight. They're lethargic. They've got diabetes. They don't have energy. You know, they don't think. Yeah. You know, it's hard to fight corruption like that.
The diabetes is through the roof, and it's because of fructose. And the thing is, fructose is now put in absolutely everything.
Everything. Yeah.
So you can't even afford an avocado. You know, but you can get for $3.99, you get a full Big Mac and everything else, which is full of fructose. So the Americans are all feeding on that kind of stuff. How can it transform itself?
Yeah, well, you just look at the weight. I mean, the average American woman, I think today, weighs 170 pounds, which is what the average American man weighed 50 years ago. And the average American man has a 40-inch waist, which, you know, back at what I remember it, you had to go to special stores to get. I mean, that's the. I mean, that we have just literally gone to pot here in the last, less than a generation, I guess.
Right. So, Donald, how is that going to change?
Well, I don't know. One way it could change, I guess, is dramatically and harshly. Is if, you know, the power goes off. I mean, if this Mad Max Thunderdome type of situation happens, which could happen, you know, eventually, so people are forced to forage. I mean, a lot of people would die, obviously, because those people are not going to be able to survive very well. But, you know, you have people eating them, I guess. I mean, the potential is there for a really ugly science fiction movie. But, you know, the last 2 years, we've been living a pretty ugly science fiction movie. So I said at the beginning of this, I don't know what the end game is. I don't know where it's going. But and if we're watching it at home, if we're watching, you know, you and your fellow actors in a movie like this, we'd be saying, "Wow, this is what's going to happen next." We'd be on the edge of our seats. But it's not as much fun when you're actually in the middle of it.
No, not at all. No, not in the least. But I do believe that the human spirit is more powerful than this stuff, and that there can be transformation. And part of it is also, I mean, obviously, the education that Americans now have, which is pretty minimal, and the whole nature of the fact that everybody's just basically watching TV and on the internet, you know, 24/7. You know, you got to throw all that stuff away and start using our bodies and our brains again. It's the only solution I can think of. I mean, it's like, what is there to do other than that? But you know what? The world has always gone through transformation, and we're in the midst of a big one right now. You know, and I remain hopeful.
Well, I want to be hopeful as well, but it's just tell my conspiracy friends now when they talk about it, I don't know what the answer is to them, because just looking at it, I mean, I write about corruption all the time, whether it's even in entertainment. I mean, that's what I'm just shocked to see, you know, when you see the school boards out here and Loudoun County, Virginia, that's where I worked. It's my neighboring county. I'm in Fairfax County. Loudoun County was kind of the epicenter of these parent protests about what their kids were learning in school. And, you know, you had the government calling them domestic terrorists and all this nonsense. And I was shocked to see the attitudes of these people on the school boards, that these are little tyrants themselves. I mean, you see people like Lori Lightfoot's and people that are running these cities. Nobody saw them before until this all brought the roaches out into the light. When you're saying these people are awful, and they're in their own little way, they're just as despotic as the people that run the national government. And to see at all levels, I mean, maybe there's an honest dog catcher somewhere, I don't know, but the corruption at every level is so pervasive. that I've said, I don't know how you could get rid of that in by means that we know. I think the only thing that could happen to straighten that out would be something supernatural. To me, I think you need a God basically to clean out the mess, because I don't see how you do it. It's at every level. And like I said, when you see something at the level of it, I hear from people too that write to me about their own little things that are happening, like just in their own workplaces or in their own counties, and municipal corruption. It's unbelievable. I have a woman that I know that's a friend of mine that just has had horrible things done to her. You know, her house was destroyed against her will just because God. She spoke out about a pedophile ring, and they destroyed her life. And so, you know, there's so many stories like that. I don't know how you straighten that out. I mean, Judgment Day will be really something to behold is the only thing I can think of. So I don't know what the answers are. What this one thing about this pandemic that has proven to me is that I knew we were outnumbered. I didn't quite know how much we're outnumbered by, though. I mean, I think, unfortunately, until there are more people that are awake than listening to this and following orders, I don't see how we can make anything better.
Well, you know, it is systemic. It's in the DNA, you might say. But again, we're spiritual beings having an earthly experience. The great powers are from the spirit, the soul. And the rest of it is really just a joke. Fear is false evidence appearing real. The reality is, you know, it comes from the soul and the spirit. And that they can't control, no matter what they say. So basically, they're trying to keep you running and scared. But it's just a Punch and Judy show. It's just a really good one. You know, they've got it down. They're trying to instill fear. Fear and terror, because they feed on fear and terror. That's what they actually feed on. Yep. Just like vampires, they need that fear. And they want to, and people buy into it. And they're like children, they buy into it. Look, I've been in the profession my whole life where basically I pretend to be other people, you know. And I've done the five stages of the actor's career. You know, I began my, like every actor, playing the ingenue, you know, the lover. And then you play the hero. I played the hero for years. Then you play the villain, right? Then you play the loser. And then you play the monster. And, you know, and I've played the serial killers and the psychopaths and the mafia guys and all that. And I'm very convincing at it when I do it. You know, when I did The Beast, for example, you know, some people want to like that. But it's all bullshit, kids. We're just acting. It's just acting, okay? It ain't real. Well, this hologram has got us convinced that it is real. That this, you know, this virus is the most dangerous thing since, you know, whatever. If you look at the numbers, look at the goddamn numbers. The stats are even less than 5 years before that. Well, let's go back to 2012, when suddenly Bill Gates is talking about vaccinating the whole world and going to Africa. Now, we also discovered that, hey, guess what? You can't sue vaccines. Oh, really? Pharmaceutical companies pay out billions in lawsuits, right? So they might make 8 or 10 billion. They pay out 2 billion in lawsuits. But with the vaccines, guess what? You can't sue them. Now, until we have some enlightened leadership, how can you have enlightened leadership if they're getting paid 100 grand, 250 grand, 450 grand, 500 grand, a million to keep their mouth shut?
Right.
It's the corruption. It's the ethics. That's the problem.
And that's the problem, too, which you mentioned about it's so many people profit off of the system. Like, you know, I was saying, just the medical system, just to overturn that. I mean, look how many people would be devastated by it. How many people are profiting off this? All the insurance companies, all the executives there, all the big pharma companies, all the executives there, hospital administrators, hospital executives all across the country, top doctors. They're all making unbelievable amounts of money off this system. So how do you, and they're the ones running it. So how do you possibly get them to, I mean, you know, people don't want to give up a dime. How do you possibly get them? Well, you know, you're going to have to sacrifice, but it's not going to happen. And that's why I said when they were talking about before Obamacare, the first thing they should have done, they should have been bringing all those people before Congress, and they should have been grilling them and questioning them. Why does this medicine cost $300 here where you can go to Cuba and get it for 5 cents? You know, explain that.
Yeah.
But they didn't do that. Instead, they asked them their advice. What can we do? Well, what do you think they're going to say? They want to keep making a lot of money. So, that's the problem.
Well, it's like what Christ said, the truth shall set you free. And the only thing that will set us free is the truth. Just keep telling the truth, Donald. That's all you can do, you know. And every revolution starts with one single voice, where basically somebody says, hey, you know, this is not fair. This is not right. You know, this is not right. So if enough people out there say, hey, this is not right, and you know what? There's a lot more of us than there is of them. That's the reality. Are a tiny minority, but they have their hands on the steering wheel.
Right, right.
That's all.
They've got so many people out there that are dull and disinterested that are just sitting there and watching and not doing anything. And it's you can take it down to a level when you see things happening where, like, somebody's that's happened, going back to, was it Kitty Genovese in the 60s in New York, that, you know, got raped and nobody even called the police. You see that on that level where people don't want to become involved. They're not willing to help somebody in distress. So I think if you magnify that, you know, if you're not willing to do that, then how are you not willing to fight for, you know, because, you know, I don't want to leave this country as bad as I think it's going to be for my children and hopefully one day grandchildren. I have a stake in it, but so many people don't see it. They just seem to, well, you know, it's okay for me. And I'm doing okay now, money wise. But I look at it like, wow, this is becoming a nightmare. And young people today, they don't have a chance. And the phony unemployment statistics, they don't bring any comfort to people to know how they're really calculated. But it's, we're living in interesting times, that for sure. We've probably got about 5 minutes left. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about or mention? Because you've got so many areas of interest and expertise, whatever you want to talk about.
Well, you know what I think is going to occur? I really do buy into the scenario. I don't know if you guys listen to Dark Journalist, but yeah, I think he's a brilliant guy, and other people that have been talking, that the next stage of this little dance after the vaccine dance is over there'll be some stories about war, but basically it's going to be alien invasion. And out of the blue, we're going
Project
to
be Bluebeam.
We're going to be attacked by aliens, and they have technology to do all that kind of nonsense. Yes. And that'll be the next. Werner von Braun, you know, founder of NASA and all the German scientist told very clearly before he died, he stated that, you know, the next stage, he said, will be terrorists. And then after the terrorists will come, asteroids and this and that. But the last, he said, will be alien invasion. And I believe that, you know, there's going to be an attempt at trying to do that. You know, they're already starting, the Pentagon is already starting talking about the reality of UFOs. They're calling them whatever they are, unidentified aerial phenomena.
Well, these people, you know, next to the JFK assassination, my main area of interest as a teenager was UFOs, and I read everything on the subject. And, you know,
There's some evidence that Marilyn Monroe was killed because apparently she was going to expose the UFO thing, that John Kennedy knew about it, Nixon knew about it, Ronald Reagan knew about it. Only certain people were informed. The whole Star Wars thing.
Well, you know. I had Laura Eisenhower on my show, Eisenhower's granddaughter, and she claims that, you know, that Ike knew all about it and that, you know, seen all the aliens from Roswell. I mean, there's obviously something there, but what really gets my attention is how now the same people, I mean, 60 Minutes had a show keeping UFOs serious. Tucker Carlson's had tons of stories on this. These videos have been out there for 50 years. I mean, these are not new things. The evidence is overwhelming that something was there, some phenomenon, but they ridiculed those people. They treated them. They dismissed it like people that say JFK was killed by a conspiracy. Why suddenly are they taking this seriously and acting like they didn't do that? Because they're now, and I, you know, that's why I agree with you. I think, you know, this Project Blue Beam that they're talking about, the fake alien invasion, something's happening, and I don't know how they're going to produce it, but as the old Twilight Zone episode says, you know, don't go on the ship. I'm not going on the ship.
Well, Dr. Stephen Greer is a friend of mine, you know, I think he's an absolutely brilliant man who started the Disclosure Project, you know, for a long time now, for 35 years, has been exposing this for many, many years, and he argues that the basic reason, and I agree with him, is because they have had, and they do have the technology, they have had contact with these creatures and beings, and that basically, like things like zero-point energy does exist, and it's basically, they're trying to keep it away because the military-industrial, you know, petrodollar, all that, those interests are stopping it from being released. But they will eventually have to, and eventually the truth will come out. And he argues that we can, you know, forget about the government, connect directly, and also that perhaps some of these beings are actually going to try to help us. So, yes, it's going to be a spiritual, it's spiritual warfare is what it is. That's what we're involved in. And we just have to keep battling, you know, and try to do the best we can. It's all we can do. But I gather nobody called to ask any questions. So, hello.
Don might be muted there. Don, you got your
Sorry about that. I was muting because you guys said you heard my chair rung. Sorry about that. Yeah. No, no calls. I'm sorry, Chuck. Chuck. Nick. But yeah, sorry about that. We're almost out of time. I want to make sure, and I'm sorry if I was muted. Please give out any links or anything. And tell anything you want to promote. Go ahead and do it in the time we have left.
Well, like I said, I'm working on a bunch of projects, and hopefully I can manifest one or two of them. You know, I'm not going to talk about them, but they are in the process of being developed. But one of the things I do want to do, of course, is the Selling Sickness. But there's a bunch of stuff that I'm getting now that I'm getting back on my feet. I'm starting to audition again. I'm starting to, you know, because it's not over till the fat lady sings, and she ain't sung yet. So I'm gonna keep going.
Well, that's great. You have lots of fans out there, and I'm a big fan of yours, and I'm honored to know you, and I appreciate you coming on the show, and it's always great to talk with you because you really are a Renaissance man. You know so much about, you know, about so many things, and you're like a walking encyclopedia. So it's and you can do it all kind of in a theatrical way because you're an actor. So it's you're just a really interesting guy, and I'm really pleased and happy for you on the show. So please, we got to keep in touch, and we'll talk about the project you were talking about, and you know, I wish you the best of luck, and you know, take care of yourself, and I'm waiting for my music. It should be coming up here, but we'll talk again soon. And the Russian friend that's the one that hooked me up with you, is he okay? I haven't heard from him for a long time.
Alexander is doing well. And, okay, great. Thank you, Donald, and it's been a real pleasure. And let us continue in this pursuit towards finding the truth. It's the only worthwhile pursuit. And you know what? The truth will set us free. So absolutely. I ain't worried. And thank I ain't fearing it. Ain't fearing any man.
That's great. That's the way it is. Nick Mancuso, thanks so much for being with us. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Donald Jeffrey Show.
Take care, Donald.
Take care. Thank you.